an incredible story, the Book of Esther. I mean, it's just powerful. It has adventure. It has suspense. It's even got things mixed in it with courage and hope. And at the same time with all of that, it adds this humor to it. There's a little bit of humor in there. And then we just see this great twist in this whole story. It's got all these things. Even the words of Mordecai that we saw last week at the end of chapter 4, they are so powerful. They're passion-filled words. He says this in Esther 4. He says, "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." And then Esther, as she hears those words given to her from Mordecai, she comes back with this incredibly courageous response. And she says this at the end of chapter 4. She says, "Go, gather all of the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young woman will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Like, what an incredible, courageous thing to do during this time. And this is what sets Esther apart from, and makes her just this important person in history. And if you remember, all of these events that we've gotten through chapter 4 have led to Haman hating Mordecai because he would not bow down to him. Mordecai would not bow because, as the Ten Commandments say, you don't bow before anything on earth, whether it's a thing or a person. And so he would not bow before Haman. And so Haman doesn't want to just get rid of Mordecai. He wants to get rid of every single one of the Jews. And so a decree has gone out that 1 year from that decree, all of the Jews in the Persian kingdom would be killed, be wiped out. And so this is where Mordecai is challenging Esther to go say something to the king. But to go into the king's presence could mean death if you come uninvited. And this is where we are. C.S. Lewis talks about the importance of staying loyal to a cause that is greater than ourselves. And he says, well, he really talks about this in quality of the terms of the quality of somebody's chest. He says, what we need are people with chests. We would say it today, we need people with guts, right? They have the guts to say that I'm going to stand up for this thing, and if I die, I die. We need people who are courageous no matter what, no matter what the cost. And this is why Esther is such a great person. She doesn't just say she's going to do something. Well, I'll probably do that, I'll do that, and then never does it. She actually does what she says. And she does it not knowing if she's going to live through the day in that. And so now we get to chapter 5 and we enter into the suspense of this whole story here. Esther has just said she's going to go to the king uninvited. Again, this could mean her instant death for doing this. Even though she's the queen, it still means it could be her instant death. And chapter 5 picks up 3 days later from the end of chapter 4. And it's where Esther is preparing to go into the presence of the king, to stand before him, not knowing if she'll live. And so it's 3 days after the end of chapter 4. And she literally is going to break the law of the land by voluntarily going into the presence of the king, interrupting him in the court. And so these 3 days that happen between the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5 are a time when Esther draws on the source of her strength. And it's easy in the silence and the gap of chapter 4 to chapter 5 to miss this, because it's silent about these 3 days, right? And so we can miss the source of her strength. It can be easy to miss it and think that Esther was just born with this courage in her life. The thing is, though, is that nobody is born courageous. We have to grow in that. And so this leads me to ask this question this morning for all of us, me included. Are we modeling authentic? authentic godly character? Are we modeling that in our lives? Who God is? Are we living like Jesus in our actual everyday lives? That's what this is about. See, Esther wasn't born with a sensitive conscience and a courageous heart. She learned that from her cousin, who became her mentor and her adoptive parent. And as we saw in chapter 4, Mordecai knew just how far he could push and stretch and challenge Esther. And Esther, as we saw, rose to that challenge, saying, I will do exactly what you want me to do, what you've taught me to do. And this wasn't the only thing that she said. She said to Mordecai, what I want you to do now is I want you to get every single Jew who is in the capital of Susa, get them together and have every single one of them fast for 3 days. And I'm going to do the same thing here in the castle, in the palace, and I'm going to take care of that. Me and my handmaidens will do the same thing. And after that, after these 3 days, when we all fast, then I will go to the king. Now, during this time of fasting, what she would be doing is she'd be waiting upon the Lord in prayer. That's what fasting's all about. It wasn't necessarily, they weren't fasting to lose weight. They were doing this for a spiritual reason. And when something this big happened, it wasn't time to feast and to have fun. Things got really intense. And so they filled that time that they would normally spend, you know, preparing and eating food. They would spend that time, instead of doing that, with times of prayer, times of quiet fasting. And so Esther challenged Mordecai to get as many of God's people as he could and have them fast and pray for her. Pray for me, she said, and fast for me, and I and my maidens will do the same thing. And then we'll see what God will do. She was determined to wait upon God and allow him to guide her thoughts and to help her know what to say and what to do with the king. Now, even though we aren't told what happens during this time, there's this gap of 3 days between chapter 4 and chapter 5. We know that they're praying and they're fasting. But don't think during those 3 days where nothing is written that God isn't doing anything, that God isn't involved in this situation. Don't think like God's out there and he's busy doing other things. No, you see, God may be invisible, but he's at work in this time. And that's the beauty and sometimes the challenge of God's invisibility. The beauty is he's at work. The challenge is that we don't always see it. And so this is what God's doing. In fact, he could be moving in 1,000 places at once, working in situations that are beyond our control, doing these things. And you see that during our waiting times, God isn't only working in our hearts, but he's also working in the hearts of other people. That's what he's doing. In Isaiah chapter 40, you see it on the screen, it says in verse 29, he gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. Now, these words are so powerful and they are so important for us today. And you may have heard these like lots and lots of times, or maybe this is the first time you heard it. But if you heard it lots and lots of times, it kind of seems old. Like, yeah, I've heard that before. No, these are powerful and they are important words for us today. We need to go to God and allow him to renew our strength. This verse teaches us that there's some things that happen when we wait on God. The first thing is we renew our strength. We may feel weak. We might even be intimidated by what is standing in front of us, by what is happening in our lives in this moment. But while we wait and we wait on God, when we turn to him, we exchange our weakness for God's strength. That's what happens in our waiting times. The second thing that happens is we get a new perspective. It tells us here in these verses that we shall mount up with wings of eagles. You know, on a clear day, an eagle can see a fish in a lake from miles and miles away. And when God does this for us, and we go to Him, we wait on Him, it's like we have this different perspective on things. We rise up with these eagle wings and we gain God's perspective on what we are dealing with. But wait, there's more. We find a new energy. It says they shall run and not be weary. Do you see that? That's future tense, right? They shall. When we come face to face with the thing that's just bringing pain and fear and whatever it is into our lives, we will encounter it with a new strength when we wait upon God. We will have extra energy to use. How many of us could use some extra energy? It comes when we wait upon God in our difficult situations. And then one last thing we see here. We will have a greater determination. It says they shall walk and not faint. See, God gives us a reassurance in the midst of this thing that we're facing. And we begin to understand that we can go through this with God by our side. He is not going to leave us. And so we have this determination. And when we wait, nothing is really happening, right? I mean, at least nothing visible is happening. We could easily think that, why am I waiting on God? This is like waiting in vain. It's not doing anything. It's not helping my situation. Let me tell you, that's exactly what the enemy wants you to think when you are trying to wait on God. That it's not worth it. It's not going to do anything. He wants us to think that waiting on God is a waste of time. Don't believe him. Don't believe that lie. Because when that thought comes into your mind, you need to speak the truth of this verse to yourself. Remind yourself what waiting on God really does. It's not a waste of time. Reject that. And then a little later in Isaiah 40, verse 10, it says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." And then verse 13. "For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not. I am the one who helps you." I believe that Esther understood this about God, and this is what strengthened her in this moment. While she fasted and waited on God for 3 days. Not only did she do this, but Mordecai and many of the other Jews in the city were doing the same thing. And as God was gripping Esther's heart, she became unafraid of what she faced in her life. It was a silent but powerful time in Esther's life, these 3 days. And nothing is written about, but we see it. The results of it here in chapter 5. And maybe you're in a place right now in your life. Maybe it's time for you to pray and to fast and to ask some close friends to pray and fast with you. Maybe it's time to say, I'm not going to rush into this thing that's standing in front of me that just looks terrible or is horrible. Because I don't know what to do. I don't know what path to take here right now. And so I'm just going to take some time and I'm going to give this to God. I'm going to listen to God and see what's happening, what he's speaking to me in this moment. Psalm 32. We will get to Esther, trust me. Psalm 32, verse 6 says, "Therefore, let everyone who is godly offer prayer to you at the time when you may be found. Surely in a rush of great waters they shall not reach him. You are a hiding place for me. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with shouts of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you." You see, when you wait, what you do is you listen. You meditate on your favorite verses in the Bible. And if you don't have any favorite verses, by golly, you better start finding them. And think about those. Write the passages down, whatever. But meditate on the Word of God. Read the Word of God. Think about the Word of God. And then quietly give attention to His presence in your life for the direction that He wants to lead you in. And I really, really believe that this is what's happening during this time between these two chapters here in Esther's life. This is what's going on. And as she prepares to go before the king, she waits. She thinks. She prays. She has times where she stays quiet. And she has times where she's listening to God. This is what's going on. And because of this, Esther can go before the king, and she can go before him calmly, wisely, and confidently. This is why. Like I said, we get to Esther 5. Here we are. Let's look at verse 1 and 2 to start. Esther 5, verse 1 says, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter." Now, if you remember, a few weeks ago, we looked at this verse in Proverbs. And this verse in Proverbs really, really still rings true. And it's here, Proverbs 21:1. It says, "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will." There has never been a king who intimidated God. Never. No matter how wealthy they were, no matter the size of their kingdom, no matter how great their army was, no one intimidates God. God can handle anyone. Just think about that this morning. We see this in this verse. God can handle anyone. He can handle your husband. He can handle your wife. He can handle your kids. He can handle me as your pastor. He can handle the person who just really angers and annoys you. He can handle your enemy. He can handle whatever situation that's intimidating and painful in your life right now. He can handle it. And Esther walks in the confidence of God. That's what we see here. She doesn't go into the courtroom with all this fear. She stands in God's strength. It says there in verse 1 and 2 that she stood in the inner court of the king's palace. And then a little later it says, "When the king saw Queen Esther standing there." She's not trembling. Remember, she could have easily been killed for going into this area before the king. She's doing what's never been done before, but she's standing tall, and she's standing in the confidence of God. That's what the waiting did for her. And then it goes on, verse 3. It says, "And the king said to her, 'What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom.'" Now, this is incredible. Just think about this whole scene here. Esther has no idea what's going to happen to her, right? She could have been killed for going in there. And then the king just simply says to her, "Hey, what's going on? What do you want?" And then he even goes a little farther and he says, "Even if it's half of my kingdom, I'll give it to you. What is it? What do you want?" And this could be her chance right here, right? This could be the moment she brings down Haman, but it's not what she does here. Have you ever thought of that? Like, why does she not say something? He said, "I'll give you half my kingdom." And she doesn't say anything about Haman. Not yet. She understands the value of timing. She's not in a hurry here. She's not even out for vengeance, even though Haman wants to kill her and all of her people. Why is she not? It's because she had been waiting on God. She knew. And what happens is we get in a hurry when we don't wait on God. We jump ahead, and sometimes we do some stupid things when we get ahead of God. Have you ever noticed that? Hopefully you haven't seen that too many times in your life, but we've probably noticed it at least once, right? Sometimes we say things that we later regret because we got ahead of God. But when we wait on God, He gets full control of our spirit. And that's when He leads us where He pleases. That's why this waiting is so important. And it goes on in verse 4, and it says, "And Esther said, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Now, isn't this great? While she's fasting, she's also preparing a banquet. That requires tremendous, enormous control to do something like that, right? She's not eating for 3 days, but she's preparing a banquet. Now, Ann and I have a little idea what that's like. When we were in Alaska, they called upon all of the Assemblies of God pastors in Alaska to pray and fast for 40 days starting in January 1st that year. And we're like, okay, well, we're going to do this, but we're lifting weights, so we just kind of need a little something in our life. So we ate one salad a day for 40 days. That was all we ate. And the rest of the time we spent fasting and praying and all the other things we were doing. But during those 40 days, Dylan and Maya were still very young. So we had to prepare multiple meals for them every day of those 40 days. And you'd make a meal, and it would smell good, and it would look good, and you'd want to eat it, but you're like, no, I can't do it. It takes tremendous control. I'm not saying we were anything great, but I just know what Esther was going through with that self-control there. And God is at work during this waiting time here. He's given her a plan. That's why she can wait on God's timing. God gave her a plan during that 3 days. And when we wait upon God, we don't have to sit around and just stare at the floor. We don't have to just be there and sing all sorts of hymns all the time. You know, those things aren't bad. We should, you know, singing praises to God are good. We don't even have to go out on the hillside with a guitar and just, oh, look at the beauty. You know, like, again, these things aren't bad. But this is, we don't have to do all these special things. But we do have to have some time where we sit in silence by ourselves alone with God. We need that moment, those moments. Silence and solitude are so good for us. We just don't know what that's like anymore. We're so bombarded with all of these things that are happening in our lives. We've got all of this noise, all of this technology that we don't hardly have any moments of silence. But they are so good for us. And when we wait upon God, mostly we're going to go out and do our normal day. But in that normal day, you focus on God more in the midst of it. You think about Him. You think His thoughts. You think about what the Word says. And that's why the Bible is so important to us, is because we don't know God's thoughts unless we are reading what God has told us of who He is. And yes, God speaks to us, but we need the Word of God to make sure we're hearing from God. And look at what Esther does here, or doesn't do here, excuse me. She doesn't point a finger at Haman here. She doesn't just blurt out all of the things that are troubling her in this moment in the courtroom. She doesn't even try to play on the emotions of the king and just burst out into tears and all these things. She just calmly says, hey, guess what? I prepared a banquet for you, and I want you to come, and I want you to bring Haman with you. And the king's like, well, that's a great idea. I love banquets. Esther knew that, right? That's how this whole thing started in Esther chapter 1, a 6-month banquet. She knew he liked banquets. And so she throws this thing, and they come. Verse 5. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. See, the king may rule over all of Persia, all the kingdom, and Haman may be able to write and sign edicts with the king's signet ring that the king gave him, but God is the one who is in control of this entire situation. He's the one here in control. And Esther must have been thinking, oh my goodness, isn't God great? I can't believe it. I got both of them to come to this banquet. This is God's idea. This is the guy idea he gave me. But look, it's working. She must have been so excited. This plan is working perfectly. And this is amazing. It's kind of like Hannibal from the A-Team, if you're my age. I love it when a plan comes together. Maybe that's where this phrase started. I don't know. But God is full of surprises. But the thing is it takes a sensitive spirit to see those surprises. And too many Christians have been lulled into this lethargic spirit or attitude in their lives. And because of that lethargy, you know, you can still sing some of the songs. You can still quote the right Bible verses. But their Christian lives deep down are jaded. Is that where you are today? You're just jaded. You're hurt. And when we become jaded, what a lot of times happens is we become calloused and insensitive. This is when Christianity becomes boring to us. And you live your life just in mediocrity when it comes to following Jesus. And when we get this way, we end up saying these empty Christian phrases that just don't do anything. People are going through stuff. We just say something we think will work, but there's no power behind it because we don't connected with Jesus as well as we should be. See, the Christian life is one that is meant to be full of adventure. It's filled with even periodic surprises. That's what the Christian life is meant to be. You look at Esther's life here. Her walk with God was an exciting adventure. She stepped into the king's presence because she had confidence in God. She planned this whole banquet because she trusted God to do the unexpected in her life. Are you still believing God can do the unexpected? Are you still waiting on God to do His will? Who would have ever guessed God's plan for Esther? I'm like, nobody, right? But here she is. She's at this banquet with the king and with Haman. Haman, the one who wants to kill all of her people and her. He doesn't even know her because he doesn't know she's a Jew. But he wants to kill all these people. And remember, she hasn't told the king anything that was troubling her. But you have to think that he has some idea that something's wrong, right? Something's bothering her. Because Esther would never have risked coming into his presence as she did unless something was bothering her. She had a reason for it, right? And so as they're there at this banquet, he brings the subject up again. You see this in verse 6 of chapter 5. It says, "And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, 'What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled.' And then Esther answered, 'My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said.'" Now Esther, she could have easily told the king what was bothering her at the banquet. She could have easily done it in the courtroom earlier that day. But the reason that she hasn't done this is because she was trusting in God's timing that she heard from him during the 3 days of fasting in between chapters 4 and 5. She was trusting God. And she says to him, "I do have something to tell you, but I want to wait until tomorrow to tell you." Now, for some reason, and we're going to see this next week, God's timing is going to require one more day. Waiting one more day is going to cause Haman to think that he is really something special. He's been thinking, you know, I must be great, or maybe one of the greatest in the kingdom here, for the queen to want me to come to these banquets with just her and the king. Look at verse 9. "And so Haman went out that day joyfully and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home and sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. So he walks out of this banquet, right? And he's thinking, oh, man, I am so great. I'm so in. I just had a private banquet with the king and the queen, and I'm going to be in another one tomorrow night. What an incredible honor for me. This is what he's thinking, right? And he's probably trying to find anybody as he walks out of this banquet to tell them, like, have you heard? Have you heard what's going on in my life? They're like, I was at a banquet with the king and the queen, and I get to go again tomorrow with just them. And the queen invited me to this. And he's feeling like he is so great. And then he happens to, in just that moment, run into that one person he just can't stand. Mordecai. It's the Jew who won't respect him. And I believe God has Mordecai in the right place at the right time. Because he was also a part of this fasting for 3 days. And there he is. And the last time we saw Mordecai, he was sitting out at the king's gate, and he was wearing ashes and sackcloth because he had heard about the decree that went out that 1 year from now all the Jews would be killed. And he can't go into the gate because no one was allowed to go in wearing ashes and sackcloth, but he was in mourning. Here, this is not what he's wearing. 3 days later, right? He's wearing something else, and he's able to go into the king's gate. Something changed in him during those 3 days. I believe he senses God at work. He knows that something great is about to happen. And even though Haman has this power and influence in the kingdom, and even though he's made this decree that means that in now just a little less than a year, his life is over with, Mordecai isn't afraid of him. Says there, Haman didn't see him trembling as he came. He knows, Mordecai knows that God is greater than Haman. And so when Haman walks out of the palace, Mordecai's not that impressed by him. And this makes Haman furious with Mordecai. But he doesn't do anything about it right then and there. He just goes home. He's like, I know, in just a little under a year, Mordecai's going to get it. He's going to get his soon. And so right now, all he's really concerned about is he just wants to go home and brag. He wants to tell everybody about how great he is. So he sends for his wife and his friends to meet him, just so he can brag them. We see this in verse 11. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. I read this week, and I should have wrote it down, because he talks about how many sons he has. I feel like, from what I read in a couple of the commentaries, is that he had like over 100 sons. So he's like talking about how he just felt like he was the best. But he tells them, his wife and his friends, how important he thinks he is. He tells them all of this to say, I am great. I'm one of the greatest in the kingdom. And he's just sitting there in his own pride, and he tells them of his own importance. And the interesting thing is that with all of this wealth that Haman has, all this power and all this importance, you would think that he would be satisfied, right? Like, he's got all of these things. But people like Haman are never satisfied. What has him unsatisfied in his life? One guy. A guy named Mordecai. One guy who wouldn't respect him. And see, a person like Haman wants everybody to bow down to them. And if that one person, if just one person doesn't do it, it becomes the sole focus of them. And it goes on in verse 12. And then Haman said, even Queen Esther let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Finally, his wife just stops him and she says, enough! Why don't you just do something about this? I'm sick of hearing about it. Do something about it. That's what she says to him. Look at verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, and then go joyfully with the king to the feast." And this idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. Now Haman's like, "Yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know why I didn't think of it, but that's a great idea. Let's get this thing done." So he ordered these gallows to be built. Now you look at 50 cubits and you're like, "Well, that doesn't mean much to me." The height of that would be about 75 feet. That's a huge overreaction, wouldn't you think? 75 feet? And now, these aren't the gallows that we think of in the Old West, all right? Hang them high at noon. That's not what these are. Okay, this is different. This is not how they did things in Persia at this time. This was actually a giant stake. The one he's making is 75 feet. And they would impale people, and then they would hang their body from this stake and let them die off of it. And this case, it would be a 75-foot pole that be hung from, impaled. Now, the Romans got their idea for crucifixion from the Phoenicians, because they saw them doing something like that. And the Phoenicians, they already got their idea for this from the Persians here. That's why Jesus was said to have been hung on a tree. You ever wonder about that? He's on a cross, not a tree. Well, this is why. See, the Romans developed the practice, instead of just impaling somebody and hanging them there, they did develop the practice of nailing your hands and your feet to the pole. So they took it a little step further. But the Persians here just simply impaled the body to a pole. Now, it was an anguishing, humiliating, torturous, painful way to go. This is what they did. Now, Haman's hatred had so consumed him to the point where only the agonizing death of his enemy would satisfy him. And he went to sleep that night. Just think about this. He went to sleep that night listening to them build that gallows out his window. Now, we're in the middle of this incredible moment in time in Israel's history here in the book of Esther. And we're going to see, and if you've read it before, you know. We're going to see, though, that God is going to lead this to an amazing turn of events. And we're going to see a lot of this in next week in chapter 6. But we look at all of these events that happened so long ago in an ancient land. And we have to say to ourselves, we have to ask ourselves, what does this have to do for us today? Well, there are some things here that are going to help us when we go through difficult circumstances and painful things in our life. First one is, we're having fun now. First thing is that when something hard or painful happens in your life, wait on God before getting involved. We need to wait on God. We've spent a lot of time at the beginning of this sermon talking about waiting upon God. So I don't want to go too much in depth in this. But as important as this thing is that we're going through, what's even more important is the work of God doing on us, that he's doing on us while we wait on him. We need to let him work in us and on us as we wait when we go through hard situations. He works on our patience. That's a tough one. He works on our circumstances and the things that are happening. He works on us and he works on other people. And if we just jump in, or if we run ahead, we can mess up the plans and the arrangement, or the better plans and arrangements that God has set. Yes, God can work it out if we get ahead of him, but it could have been better if we just did it the way he wanted us to. And so if you're about to make a decision, wait on God. A lot of times, the bigger the decision, the longer we should wait on him. Don't get in a hurry. If you have to do something that's new to you, if you're doing something that you've never, ever done before, you better wait on God. And you may say, well, how long? Like Esther did 3 days. Is that the key? That could be 3 days, but I don't know. could be 3 weeks. It could be 3 months. The key to this, though, is while you are waiting, don't try and take things and pull them back into your own hands. Don't try to just go and just say, I'm going to do this thing now. The key is to keep yourself from trying to speed things up. Wait on God. Second, when you're dealing with a difficult person, trust God to open doors and hearts. In Proverbs 16:7, it says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Count on God to do that. The amazing thing that happens while we wait on God is that our courage grows. Instead of getting more afraid as we're waiting for this thing to happen that looks so hard and terrible and difficult, whatever it is that's in front of us, it doesn't actually make us more and more afraid. When we actually wait on God and listen to Him, it actually brings courage into our lives. We gain confidence. And God becomes so important to us, actually more important to us than anything else. His presence overshadows the intimidating circumstances that would normally immobilize us or paralyze our thoughts. And so we have to wait on Him. That's where our confidence comes from. Third, when you're going through a difficult situation, trust God to give you patience. Trust God to give you patience. Think about the patience of Esther that she must have had with this whole thing here. To wait to tell the king about what Haman was going to do. When she could have said something in the courtroom at the first banquet, but she didn't. She waited. Haman was the one who hated her people so much that he was going to have them all wiped off the face of the earth. Think about the patience she must have had with this, to wait on God's perfect timing. But this is what she does. And in difficult situations, timing is just as important as action. Sometimes it's even more important. So pace yourself. Have patience. Wait for the situation to become workable when God's timing is in your life. So you wait for that. Trust His timing. And the last thing we see here is that when you go through a difficult circumstance, ask God for courage. I really believe this is what Esther did. Because before the 3 days of fasting, if I die, I die. Right? I'll do it, but if I die, I die. But she went then and she stood in the presence of the king without fear. I believed she even gained more courage during that first banquet before the second one. Even in the presence of the person who wanted to kill her, as she waited on God's timing, she gained courage. Ask God for that kind of courage in your life, in your situation. He will give you the courage to stand. But through all of this, we need to remember Jesus. Why did they hang Jesus on a tree? There were more people who hated Jesus than loved Him, right? There were more people who cheered for His death than who wept over it. He was despised and hated by people. And so Jesus hung on a tree, died on the cross. But we also know that 3 days later, Jesus rose from the dead and the grave, and He's alive today. Now, Jesus didn't die just because a guy like Haman hated Him. He died because you and I are sinners. And the only way to satisfy the demand of a holy God in dealing with sin was to pay the penalty for the sin. And this required the price of the blood from an unspotted Lamb of God, who is Jesus Himself. So let's praise Jesus for what He has done for us. Let's come to Him for salvation. If you don't know Jesus, you can know Him today. He can cleanse you of your sins. He's the only place where we can find salvation. And then let's learn to wait and trust in Him during our difficult times of life. That's our opportunity this morning. Would you bow your heads? And you may be going through it right now. There may be pain in your life. There may be a circumstance that's just standing in front of you that's blocking you from what you want to do in your life or what you feel God is calling you to do in your life. And it's left you immobilized in this moment. You don't know what to do. You don't know which path to take. And the brokenness and the pain of that whole situation just has you there.